KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
They're there at the direction of the president in order to keep peace and allow people to be able to protest, but also to keep law and order.
In a rare move, President Trump has federalized the California National Guard. It's in response to protests over immigration enforcement in Los Angeles. For Sunday, June 8th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Ahead, the latest from Los Angeles, we will hear from a top California labor leader about a key tension point in the story, the arrest of SEIU leader David Huerta.
Is your duties to come into communities where civilians are at in full military gear and target working class people.
Also, New Jersey holds primary elections for governor this week, and we look at movie remakes, what makes them bad or good.
It's popular to diss them, but speaking as a critic, I'm more interested in what the filmmakers are trying to do this time and whether they're doing it well.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. A third day of protests in Los Angeles as members of the California National Guard arrived in the area this morning after being federalized by President Trump. As NPR's Joe Hernandez reports, Trump is activating 2,000 troops in response to protests against immigration raids.
Federal immigration raids in Los Angeles and nearby last week sparked protests in the city and beyond, some of which turned confrontational. Authorities used tear gas and pepper spray to disperse crowds, and some protesters damaged property. Trump says he is activating the National Guard to restore order, but California Governor Gavin Newsom says there was no widespread violence, and the federal government is, quote, sowing chaos so they can have an excuse to escalate. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth also says that active duty Marines at Camp Pendleton are on high alert and would be mobilized if, quote, violence continues. Joe Hernandez, NPR News.
And the LAPD has declared an unlawful assembly, and police in riot gear are clashing with protesters in downtown LA. That's closed parts of the 101 freeway. Authorities use shields to push back people and maintain a perimeter. A new Trump administration travel ban takes effect tomorrow, banning citizens of 12 countries from visiting the U.S., and travelers from seven others would face restrictions. Social worker Jim Ray helps immigrant families in South Carolina who have fled Taliban-controlled Afghanistan.
Where it hurts the most is that the most vulnerable in Afghanistan cannot have an opportunity to come any longer. And that is primarily because of the women's rights being stripped from them.
Trump says the restriction is being posed on countries that harbor terrorists, fail to cooperate on visa security, and have a high rate of citizens who overstay their visas. Health officials in Gaza say at least six Palestinians were killed today while trying to reach food aid sites run by private U.S. contractors. Israel's military says it fired warning shots. And NPR's Daniel Estrin has more.
The new food program in Gaza is backed by the U.S. and Israel. It's meant to replace aid distributed by the United Nations and to isolate Hamas. But hunger remains severe in Gaza. In the last 2 weeks, Gaza health officials say more than 100 people have been killed trying to access these food sites. The Israeli military warned civilians not to approach the sites before opening hours. But the food sites have had erratic opening hours. One site announced an early opening and crowds gathered early at another site. Military officials say troops fired warning shots a distance away from two aid sites Sunday as suspects approached troops. Gaza health officials report more than 100 people killed in Israeli strikes this weekend. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. After a record-breaking season at the box office, Broadway is celebrating at this hour with the 78th annual Tony Awards. That's Broadway's highest honors. Jeff London says all eyes are on the top award, Best Musical, which can help a show become a hit.
Five shows are up for the award, but only one can win. Will it be Buena Vista Social Club, based on the best-selling album of Cuban music, Death Becomes Her, based on the popular movie, or the original musical, Maybe Happy Ending, about robots who fall in love? All have 10 nominations.
When you're in love, you are the loneliest.
Or will it be two shows based on true stories which feature corpses in the plot? Dead Outlaw, which picked up 7, or Operation Mincemeat, with 4.
For some of
Five shows will be doing numbers on the CBS broadcast Sunday evening, hosted by Cynthia Erivo. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
At the weekend box office, Lilo and Stitch took the top spot for the third weekend in a row, with an estimated $32 million. In second place, the John Wick spinoff, Ballerina, with $25 million. The movie makes a sideline character out of Keanu Reeves' John Wick and focuses on Ana de Armas. The Lionsgate release cost a reported $90 million to make. In third place, Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning, with $15 million. I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Lemelson Foundation, dedicated to improving lives through invention, innovation, and climate action, and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantsFDN.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. The California National Guard arrived in Los Angeles early Sunday morning after President Trump federalized state troops. The move came after Friday immigration raids in and around Los Angeles sparked multiple protests against federal agents. Pockets of violence broke out in some of them. The president ordered at least 2,000 California National Guard troops to respond to the demonstrations. California Governor Gavin Newsom called the move unnecessary and, quote, purposely inflammatory. It is the first time in 60 years a president has used a rare federal power to deploy National Guard troops without the agreement of a state's governor. In a moment, we will hear from Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass, but we will start our coverage with NPR's Luke Garrett. Hey, Luke.
Hey there, Scott.
Starting out, what exactly is Trump's order, and is he allowed to do this, to take this step without the state agreeing?
In short, yes. He can take control and federalize portions of the California National Guard under a rarely used federal law. But this law does not allow these troops to engage in ordinary law enforcement action, according to Georgetown law professor Stephen Vladek. This means that the deployed 79th Infantry Brigade of the California National Guard is not authorized to actively face off or use force against protesters. Instead, Trump's action specifically directs these troops to protect and support immigration law enforcement.
Could that change, though?
It could. Yes, it could. A more aggressive option is available to the president, and that's declaring the Insurrection Act, which does allow Trump to unleash military force against U.S. civilians. He reportedly wanted to use this extreme power in 2020 during the protests against the murder of George Floyd. And this afternoon, while speaking to reporters, Trump left open the possibility of invoking the Insurrection Act and sending more troops to other cities. Now, this act has not been invoked since 1992 during the race riots in L.A., but to be clear, Trump has not made this move yet in this case.
In a moment, we're going to hear more about real pushback on the local and state level here. What is the Trump administration saying today to justify this?
So the Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem thanked the president for the deployment of the National Guard troops. Here she is on CBS News.
They're there at the direction of the president in order to keep peace and allow people to be able to protest, but also to keep law and order.
And Noem justified the deployment by saying local law enforcement failed to quickly protect ICE and DHS officers during immigration raids and the ensuing protests.
When we ask for backup in a situation, LAPD has waited hours to respond, and they've waited until we have an officer in a dangerous situation until they come in.
Now, local law enforcement officials say they have responded and supported federal agents when they called for help. I just got off the phone with LAPD, and they told me that they responded to these calls for help within 55 minutes, not hours.
NPR's Luke Garrett, thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott.
Joined now by Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass, who earlier today called the deployment of the National Guard a chaotic escalation. Mayor, thanks for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me on.
I want to start with your response to Secretary Noem's characterization of the LAPD here.
Well, the LAPD was ready and able to provide the support when it was asked for. You can't expect for them to have hundreds of officers ready when they did not know when the raid was going to take place. Mm-hmm. And so I believe that these raids and now the federalization of troops to come into Los Angeles is an intentional effort to sow chaos. The fear in our city is real, rippling through every community and every family. You have people now who are going to be afraid to go to work on Monday, kids who are going to be afraid to go to school.
Mm-hmm.
I've been in touch with immigrant rights leaders, and you know we have a...
What are you telling them?
Well, I'm actually trying to assist them because they're trying to reach out to the people who have been detained. And I'm asking mm-hmm. the federal government, to allow these visits to take place. That is what has happened for years and years and years when people were arrested for, mm-hmm. Immigration reasons. And so families now, they might know their relative has been taken away. They don't know if their relative is still in the United States. They don't know where in the city, which is now, we know that a lot of people have been moved out of the city, to another area.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what my conversations have been with the immigrant rights leaders, trying to collaborate, trying to find out what they need, and trying to be responsible to those needs.
Mayor, I want to ask about the presence of the National Guard in the city. You have raised concerns about it, a chaotic escalation, as I said before. What are your specific concerns tonight, especially as we are beginning to see interactions between protesters and law enforcement already?
Well, there you go. That's my specific concern, is that this city right now is a tinderbox, and I do not want to see civil unrest take place in this city, and I think bringing the National Guard in is provocative. What was happening in terms of the protests and all was well under control by the police department. And Los Angeles County has multiple cities in it. And so what you saw take place yesterday was not inside Los Angeles City. But our law enforcement officers are well equipped here to handle the level of protest that you saw. And that's why Governor Newsom did not make the request for federal support,
mm-hmm.
And neither did I. In terms of, we thought more support was needed that our local law enforcement couldn't handle. So if you have...
Still...
go ahead.
The federalized troops are in the city now. Is the city coordinating them? Is the city working with them?
Well, the city is not coordinating them, no. But the city, of course...
Coordinating with them, rather. Are you in communication
with these units
that are now?
Yes.
And how's that going? Is that collaborative? Is it tense?
No. It is collaborative at this point. It's not tense. There are some things that we're trying to work with them on specifically. For example, the federal building was vandalized with graffiti all around. We want to remove that graffiti, but we need federal permission in order to do that. So I spoke to the U.S. Attorney, Bill Bailey, and I made that request that we wanted access so we could clear off the graffiti. The graffiti makes the area looks terrible, and we want that taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
But, this is the first time that the National Guard has been federalized since 1992. I was here then, very much involved in the community at that time. But at that time, there was real civil unrest all around the city. This is not the situation that we are facing now. You had protests. You had some violence and vandalism that happened, but it was, the disruption last night was about 120 people. Why does that warrant the National Guard?
You say that, and you're right, this is a much different scale at this point, but you and others have said that you're concerned this could escalate. There are many people arguing that that's exactly what the president wants.
Mm-hmm.
You have people coming out wanting to confront these troops who they don't want in their city. So I'm asking you, do you think there is a way, is there an off-ramp at this point? Do you see a way to avoid a crisis at this point, given the various motivations?
Absolutely. There's no reason for this to continue to escalate at all. And now having said that, we also want to make sure that the protests stay peaceful, that we don't give the National Guard or the Trump administration the excuse. But when mayhem breaks out, it's going to be addressed. And so I'm just hoping that people peacefully demonstrate, they exercise their First Amendment right, but they do not cross the line into violence.
That's Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
We're going to hear one more voice here. That is reporter Steve Futterman, who is out on the streets in and around Los Angeles watching what is happening. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Scott.
You are right now at one of the locations where Guard troops have been mobilizing. What are you seeing?
Well, I'm in downtown L.A., where the National Guard troops have been since early this morning. Now, for most of the day, as several hundred protesters eventually gathered, there were no major problems. The Guard members stood with their powerful weapons. But in the early afternoon, things suddenly and dramatically changed. Guard troops started moving towards the protesters, causing quite a bit of panic. And a block away, it got even worse. My colleague, NPR's Liz Baker, has been in front of the Metropolitan Detention Center. Now, that's where many of the detainees from the last 48 hours were at least initially held. She says things there had also been peaceful until law enforcement began using pepper spray and tear gas to disperse around a couple hundred protesters. Moments later, a large caravan of ICE vehicles drove through. And law enforcement in the area I'm at right now has since declared this an unlawful assembly and have warned people if they don't leave, they could be arrested.
We just heard the mayor saying she doesn't want these troops there. The governor said the same. What are people around you saying about this?
Well, they're not happy. They feel the confrontations and violence we have seen the last couple of days have been provoked. Estrella Correll is a social worker. She doesn't feel there is any need to have the guard here at all.
I think it's ridiculous. I think Trump is trying to make a show when there's armed guards. You know, we all have signs, and I just think it's him trying to escalate and make a situation and a show, which is what he is. A showman, and that's what he cares about. So I just think there's no need for it. LA City is not out of control. We are peacefully protesting people being dragged out of their homes and schools.
Steve, people are clearly worried. Are they factoring that into their decision about whether or not to come out and protest?
Oh, absolutely. The people I spoke with are indeed worried, as the mayor said, about things escalating even more. Another person I spoke with on the street today, her name is Elizabeth Torres. She told me for her, it's been the drip, drip, drip of escalation that actually brought her here.
Well, Friday, I started seeing on social media, on the news, everything that was happening. Yesterday, all day, I saw it, and I was anxious. And this morning, I woke up, I'm like, I have to do something.
What should we be looking for next?
Well, I think tonight will be the first test. The last two nights, there's been quite a bit of violence. But I think it's going to be most important to look at tomorrow and the next few days. If there are new ICE raids, and there very well could be, there's almost certain to be a response.
That is Steve Futterman covering this for us in Los Angeles. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Scott.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. President Trump deployed California National Guard troops to Los Angeles today to respond to clashes between immigration officers and protesters. This after dozens of people were detained by immigration agents Friday. Trump calls the situation a riot, but says so far he doesn't think it's an insurrection. Israel says it will prevent an aid boat carrying Greta Thunberg and other activists from reaching the Gaza Strip. They plan to deliver aid and raise awareness about the humanitarian crisis in the war-ravaged enclave. Israel says its blockade is to prevent Hamas from importing arms. And Carlos Alcaraz rallied from two sets down and saved three match points to beat Jannik Sinner and win the French Open for the second straight year. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Scott Detrow. Here is a fun fact about New Jersey. The state constitution in 1947 specified off-year elections for governor so they wouldn't be overshadowed by presidential races. So it is one of only two states holding governor's races this year, along with Virginia. The New Jersey primary is Tuesday, and there are a lot of contenders to replace outgoing Democratic Governor Phil Murphy. And the result could say something about how voters view the Trump White House. Nancy Solomon covers New Jersey politics for member station WNYC, and she's going to talk about this with us now. Hey, Nancy.
Hi, Scott.
So let's start with this. It sounds like there are a lot of candidates, and it's going to be a hard-to-predict election day.
Yeah, there are 11 main candidates, and turnout is expected to be low, so that means a very small number of voters could decide this, especially on the Democratic side, which is much more competitive. People think of New Jersey as a reliably blue state, but that's not true when it comes to electing a governor. Whenever one party has held the seat for two terms, and that's what we have right now with Governor Phil Murphy, the other party has won the election. And that's going back to 1962. So, you know, and one of the other things to keep in mind about New Jersey is that there are as many registered independents as there are Democrats. And they tend to be less engaged in the primary, but the general election will very much hinge on them.
So President Trump has already weighed in on the Republican side, and that in itself is pretty interesting because it means he is paying close attention to New Jersey, which says something, right?
Yeah, I think it really does. He endorsed the Republican frontrunner, former state assemblyman and third-time candidate Jack Cittarelli, and that says a lot. In 2016, Cittarelli called Trump a charlatan and embarrassing. When Cittarelli ran again in 2021, he didn't even seek an endorsement. But, you know, he didn't criticize Trump either at that time. But this time around, Cittarelli had made a strong play and got Trump's endorsement. Here's a clip from what the president said on a campaign call this past week.
It's a big deal. It's being watched actually all over the world because New Jersey's ready to pop out of that blue horror show.
Another candidate, conservative talk show host Bill Spadia, is actually closer with Trump, but it looks like the president thought he had a better chance of winning in November with Cittarelli.
Let's talk about the Democratic side for a moment, because this primary comes a moment when the party is really struggling with how to oppose Trump administration policies. Is that a big issue in the primary for governor?
Yes. All six candidates are talking about how they'll resist Trump. Newark Mayor Raz Baraka has gotten a lot of attention for showing up at an immigration detention center and getting arrested by ICE officers. Mikey Sherrill, a moderate congresswoman, makes the case that she's the one who's been on the front lines in Washington fighting Trump. And she voted to impeach the president when she was just newly elected to a very purple district in New Jersey, where Trump had actually won in 2016. Jersey City Mayor Steve Fulop is courting progressives and pretty much the left wing of the party. And he kind of criticizes Governor Murphy and says he's taken too conciliatory of a tone toward Trump. And he'll be the fighter and the political reformer. You know, and I've noticed even in the past few weeks that Josh Gottheimer, another member of Congress who's probably the furthest to the right of all the Democrats, has shifted his rhetoric from affordability and lowering taxes to fighting Trump. The remaining two candidates, former state senator Steve Sweeney and teachers union president Sean Spiller, they both have legitimate shots at this as well. Sweeney has the support of a powerful political machine in South Jersey, and Spiller has $40 million from the teachers union.
I mean, besides President Trump, what are the other issues at stake in this race?
You know, gubernatorial elections in New Jersey are super important. It's one of the most powerful governorships in the country in terms of what the governor can actually do. The Democrats are talking about the trains not running on time, the state's highest in the nation property taxes, building more affordable housing. The Republican frontrunner, Cittarelli, says he'll end immigrant sanctuary policies and also shift school funding from urban districts to suburban ones. So these are some of the key issues they're looking at.
WNYC's Nancy Solomon, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This year's live-action adaptation of Disney's 1937 classic Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs disappointed both critically and financially. But that has not stopped Hollywood from churning out more remakes. In theaters right now is Lilo and Stitch, a live-action remake of the 2002 original.
Ew. We are not keeping this thing.
Ohana means family. Family means nobody gets left behind.
Or forgotten.
And soon to come will be DreamWorks' live-action version of How to Train Your Dragon.
Maybe they're not as bad as we think they are.
Also ahead of us, The Naked Gun, with Liam Neeson starring as the son of the detective played by Leslie Nielsen in the original series.
Who are you?
Frank Drebin, police squad. The new version.
I could go on, but the fact is that remakes are a long-established and controversial well that Hollywood returns to time and time again in the hopes of capturing fans of the original and to bring in newer generations. But how many of those remakes actually measure up to the original, and what distinguishes a good remake from a bad one? To discuss, we have brought in NPR movie critic Bob Mondello and NPR Weekend Edition producer Ryan Bank. Welcome to both of you.
Good to be here.
Hey there.
Liam Neeson and Leslie Nielsen. Hard to say in the same sentence. I'm just going to say that. It's tricky, but I made it through. Bob, you watch a lot of movies, and I'm going to make an assumption here. I would guess that you are a hater, that you do not like it when Hollywood returns to the same well time and time again. Am I right or am I wrong?
You are wrong. Ah. I actually endorse the whole idea of going back. In fact, I think film is almost the only art form where people are skeptical about the idea of going back to the well. In music, if somebody wants to do a jazz version of your original song, nobody questions it. In theater, another production of Hamlet sounds like a great idea if it's a star you like. Also, historically, a lot, maybe even most Hollywood remakes have been English language versions of foreign films. Some like It Hot, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, True Lies, Scent of a Woman, The Departed, to name just a few.
When I was your age, they would say we could become cops or criminals. Today, what I'm saying is this. When you're facing a loaded gun, what's the difference?
I mean, I don't think anybody would argue that those are not good movies. This is not about nostalgia. It's not about a fan base or a familiar title, or even the Hollywood lizard eating its own tail. It's studios appropriating stuff the American public doesn't know about. And I think that's a good thing. I think the reason many film fans don't like it is because film is such a new medium. It's only 100 years old. And if the original is still around and you can watch it, that makes it a little hard to justify it unless some good artist is working on it.
Ryan, I had my point totally destroyed by NPR icon Bob Mondello. Help me out here. How do you feel? How do you feel about remakes?
All right, look, so I'll start by saying that I obviously see where Bob is coming from. And, you know, it's an interesting point that a lot of people don't think about. At the end of the day, though, for every Departed that you have and every True Lies, you have this like rash of early 2000s remakes of, I'll call them cash grabs of Japanese ghost flicks. You have The Ring, The Grudge, Dark Water.
Have you heard about this videotape that kills you when you watch it?
And while at least The Ring and The Grudge kind of had some success in the States and they stood on their own a little bit, most of them are just like photocopies of photocopies. So, look, I think there's a right way to make a remake and to do that with heart and soul and care. And then there's the Disney method. And I think that there's a perception right now for good reason that most so these mean. Days are the latter.
That is so mean. I think I also think it's not fair. I take Snow White. I think we can all agree this is the new version is not a great movie, right? And the old one is a beloved classic that has serious problems. But I think you can dislike the new one and still respect Disney for what it's trying to do there. They were faced with the 1937 property that everybody loves, but that is insensitive on issues of gender, social mobility, of it's all white, it's utterly crazy on dwarfs. I mean, you look at this and you think, well, you ought to fix it. And the folks who did it, Mayday Latina, Snow White, turned the prince into a pauper, created a whole second band of seven characters that aren't stereotyped, and made their dopey character not only smart, but also the moral conscience of the piece. They brought a lot of new ideas to the table, and I'd argue that that justifies doing a remake in the first place, whatever you think of how it worked.
Though, there's been this Disney formula of remaking all of these movies that, like, people who are parents now would be nostalgic for. And some of them, like we're going to make a live-action version of The Lion King. Like, well, no, you're just going to animate it a different way unless you have a camera on a lion who's suddenly talking. You know, like, I would think that there are some bad remakes.
Oh, no, I'm not suggesting that there aren't bad remakes. It is possible to make a bad remake. What I'm suggesting is that if you start with IP, intellectual property, that is basically strong, then you have a leg up. And it's not necessarily a bad thing to do that. And it's something, I mean, Shakespeare stole from, like, folktales and things like that. King Lear was not an original story. And it's not a bad play. I don't think anybody would argue there was.
Ryan, are there common threads, though, to when it goes awry?
I mean, I hate to be this guy, but you can always...
But be that guy.
You don't hate it.
You're reveling in this.
Okay, like, so maybe I don't... Oh, no, don't make me be this guy.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I don't hate it that much, but just for the sake of it, I'll just say, like, I'm all for thoughtful reinterpretation. Sometimes movies get made, stuff gets left on the cutting room floor, mysteries or questions remain... And it can feel good to get another chance to explore some great stories, you know, or right or wrong, as you describe with Snow White. But if all you're offering me is, hey, remember this? That was cool, right? I'm going to pass.
Except that it's always cool to explore a story that is sort of time-honored. I mean, if you look at the new Dune, nobody's going to argue that they shouldn't have made that. I mean,
and I enjoyed
concentrating
that
on the ones that don't work strikes me as not very interesting. I get that it's popular to diss them, but speaking as a critic, I'm more interested in what the filmmakers are trying to do this time and whether they're doing it well. And so that's the way I approach them.
Let me ask this then. I'm thinking of a few examples of remakes that I think really did surpass the original, even when the original was good. Ocean's 11, the Ocean's 11 remake that spawned a whole franchise. Mm-hmm. That was great.
You're a thief and a liar.
I only lied about being a thief.
You know, another one, I will say, the 90s Parent Trap, excellent movie with Lindsay Lohan. Really, really good movie. I'll stick with it.
I have a brilliant idea. I think we should switch places. I'll go back to London as you, and you go back to California as me. If we switch.
I can't argue with that.
It was great. Ryan, like, what to you, is there a formula for making a remake that transcends the original source material?
I don't know if I can give you, like, an exact formula, but I can tell you that there are plenty of examples where it works and where the remake is even better than maybe the original, or that I enjoyed more than the original. David Cronenberg's The Fly with Jeff Goldblum is a fantastic movie.
What does the disease want?
Wants to turn me into something else.
A fly got into the transmitter pod with me that first time when I was alone. Don't go back.
But since I'm from Miami, I think I want to go back to a little movie called Scarface.
Right. I've heard of this film.
Yeah, you know, a 1983 movie based on this, or the original gangster film from 1932, which told this, at the time, really relevant immigrant story of a gangster from Italy rising through the ranks of the Chicago mob.
Everybody say Tony Camotti is a big shot. He's got everything he wants. Yeah, I got everything but what I want.
And then you have, in 83, Brian De Palma directing Al Pacino in this movie that's pretty much eclipsed its source material.
Me, I want what's coming to me.
Oh, well, what's coming to you, Tony?
The world, Chico. And everything in it.
You know, he took the same story concept but made it relevant to the 1980s, and he weaved in all these plot points ripped straight from the headlines. You know, broad daylight assassinations, chainsaw massacres, cocaine bank fronts. It was simultaneously loyal to the essence of the first one while also offering this kind of creating this entirely modern storyline. And of course, you know, at the time there was a lot of controversy. A lot of Cuban Americans protested the film because they were afraid of the way it would portray Cuban immigrants at a time that they were just coming to the U.S. There's also that really horrible Cuban accent from Al Pacino. what was once considered then offensive had become this ubiquitous story of immigrant perseverance. And I think that's one great example of something that really got it right. It gave something new.
That is NPR's Bob Mondello and Ryan Bank. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Chilean farmed salmon is a prized export from the coastal waters of Patagonia, but the fish are not native there, and locals and marine biologists are raising alarms over their growing environmental toll. John Bartlett reports from Patagonia.
Just before dawn, we leave Puerto Natales aboard the Calypso, Reynaldo Caro's creaking fishing vessel, towing an old wooden rowing boat in our wake. The grey clouds glow pink over Patagonia's deep blue fjords. I've sailed these seas since I was born, says Caro. I was only a week or two old when my dad took me out to sea for the first time. 78-year-old Caro is one of the very last Cahuesca fishermen sailing these fjords. The Cahuesca are one of the semi-nomadic indigenous peoples who have navigated these shores and channels for millennia. Today, there are fewer than 1,000 Cahuesca left. He steers absent-mindedly with one elbow, eyes scanning the shoreline. But the waters he's known all his life are changing. Chile is the top exporter of farmed salmon to the US. It's the country's second largest export after copper. A quarter of the world's salmon is farmed here, yet the fish are not native to these waters, and fishermen like Caro say that they are damaging Chilean ecosystems, something the industry itself denies. One by one, Caro points out the salmon farms as we pass by. It's killing the sea floor. There's no life down there, he says. The fishing is bad now, he says. There's nothing left for us fishermen anymore. Below deck, Caro's daughter, Leticia, is preparing lunch in the tiny kitchen cabin. This is Cahuesca Wise, she says, our ancestral territory. The streams, rivers, fjords, even the sea floor, she explains, form a sacred ecosystem.
Asimismo, los ríos y lagunas y lagos que luego vienen al mar.
If these sacred spaces aren't protected, Leticia says, the legend says that great sea monsters and violent waves will consume the territory. As Caro casts for sea bass, marine biologist Claudio Caroca, who works in the fjords here, weighs in. He says that when a salmon farm is installed in the area, the ecosystem starts to change immediately with food and antibiotics for the fish. Over time, we see other types of pollution too, Caroca explains. There are the vaccines that they receive, other treatments, cleaning the hardware, and even fuel spills. The Chilean Salmon Council, which represents the major producers, declined to comment on issues the local community raised, but says it follows strict rules on antibiotics, environmental protections, and contamination. Leticia Caro isn't ready to give up the culture and way of life she grew up with just yet. I have all the hope in the world that the Cahuesca can continue to be a seafaring culture, she says.
Bueno, el mensaje es súper claro. No coma salmón.
And her message to consumers is clear. What you're eating is destroying the territory. If you don't eat salmon, you're contributing to the Cahuesca cause. But it might take some time to convince those who manage one of Chile's most lucrative exports to take her up on her plea. For NPR News, I'm John Bartlett in Puerto Natales, Chile.
This is NPR News.
Democrats wish they could win back the votes of men, such as the bros who listen to Dave Portnoy of Barstool Sports.
I think when you say the word bro, it's somebody who, you know, maybe likes sports and wants to get laid, like, which I don't think is a bad thing at all.
What drove Dave Portnoy to Trump? We ask him on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. President Trump's new ban on travel to the U.S. from 12 countries, mainly in Africa and the Middle East, takes effect tomorrow. This amid escalating tensions over Trump's unprecedented campaign of immigration enforcement. Trump says the restriction is being imposed on countries that harbor terrorists, fail to cooperate on visa security, and have a high rate of citizens who overstay their visas. Health officials in Gaza say at least six Palestinians were killed today as they tried to get to a food aid distribution site that's backed by both the U.S. and Israel. Israel says it fired warning shots as people allegedly approached the troops. Health officials say more than 100 people trying to get food have been killed in the last 2 weeks. And at the weekend box office, Lilo and Stitch took the top spot for a third weekend in a row with an estimated $32 million. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Capital One, offering their premium travel card Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at Cigna.com. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org.
NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Scott Detrow. Back to our top story. National Guard troops mobilized by President Trump have arrived in Los Angeles, where more protests are planned tonight. This after U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement sweeps sparked demonstrations over the weekend. During the protests, Service Employees International Union California leader David Huerta was injured in a scuffle with federal agents. He was treated at a nearby hospital and then detained. He remains in custody and is due to be arraigned in federal court tomorrow. Federal authorities claim Huerta was obstructing federal agents' access to a work site where they were executing a warrant. The labor union says that Huerta was detained while exercising his First Amendment right to observe and document law enforcement activity. The politically powerful union, which has over 700,000 members in the state, is planning a rally on Monday in support. And on the line with us is Sandra Diaz, who's vice president of SEIU USWW California. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having us.
I explained what the federal authorities are saying. I explained what SEIU's framing was. You tell me what you understand happened with Mr. Huerta and the agents.
Our president, David Huerta, was assaulted, was detained, was injured, and has been in detention. And who David Huerta is, let me tell you a little bit of who David Huerta is. He has decades fighting for working people in the state of California. What he was doing on Friday was standing up for workers, immigrant workers, at a time where ICE came into the city and terrorized an entire community and targeted working families.
I want to make sure I'm understanding the union's views on this the right way. What is the primary concern with these raids that were underway? And we've seen across the country these raids have ticked up in recent weeks, even compared to the beginning of the Trump administration when they were a top priority for the administration. Was the concern the way they're being carried out, the fact they're being carried out at all, who they're targeting? What is the top concern?
As a labor union, our top concern is that they're going after working families. They're going after workers day in and day out, and they're tearing our communities apart. What they did on Friday was they were going after seamstress. They went after day laborers. They went after people that all they're doing here is strengthening our economy. We are a union of immigrant workers. When this country has had its toughest moments, immigrant workers come out and they have sustained our economy and our communities when our communities have needed it the most. And now you have an administration that's singling and targeting them out and it has sent out military-like operations to go into workplaces and to gather people, completely ignoring due process and our constitutional rights.
I want to get your response to something that the U.S. Attorney for Central California said yesterday in a post about Huerta's arrest. The quote is, "Let me be clear, I don't care who you are. If you impede federal agents, you will be arrested and prosecuted. No one has the right to assault, obstruct, or interfere with federal authorities carrying out their duties." What's your response to that statement?
Our response to that statement is that we stand by people's right to peacefully assemble. We also have a question for the administration. Is your duties to come into communities where civilians are at in full military gear, use excessive force, and target working class people?
I mentioned that the National Guard has been federalized and deployed in Los Angeles. Does that fact change your plans for protesting tonight or rallying in support of Huerta tomorrow in any way, shape, or form?
You're planning on standing with allies on a peaceful vigil tonight. We are planning on holding peaceful protests tomorrow. It is imperative that we continue to defend the right to peacefully protest in this country. It's a pillar of our democracy. And we stand by the right of people to be able to engage peacefully, to hold this administration or anybody accountable. And so we're going to be out tomorrow with our members peacefully assembling and denouncing what has been taking place, the militarization of National Guard, the militarization of ICE operations with coming in full in tanks and military gear into our communities and causing terror among everyone in LA and throughout the country.
That is Sandra Diaz, who's vice president of SEIU USWW California. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's almost summer, and if recent years are a guideline, that means heightened threats of wildfires. Billowing smoke from wildfires can cause dangerous air quality levels. Air filters in homes can help manage smoke, but what if you don't have one? NPR's Alejandra Barunda set out to see if it is possible to make your own air filters.
The short answer is yes. You can build a DIY air filter in less than 30 minutes with stuff that you probably already have in your house.
My name is Elliot Gall, and I am an associate professor in the Department of Mechanical and Materials Engineering at Portland State University.
He's the designer of this air filter called the Cocoon. Graduate student Brett Stinson explains.
It's pretty simple. It's just a fabric filter. This is cotton batting and a box fan.
Basically, just a tube of fabric attached to a box fan. Gall says it's an old technology called a baghouse filter.
And it essentially is a piece of fabric that you force air through that filters out particulate matter.
To me, it looks like a blobby, puffy, 8-foot-long sausage. But it works almost as well as air filters you can buy. Here in the lab up in Portland, we load up a sealed bedroom-sized area with smoke and start the Cocoon running. Within about 10 or 15 minutes, the air is pretty much clear. And my partner and I set out to build a Cocoon for ourselves.
This is Ali and Alex's attempt to make a box fan filter.
Gall sent me a PDF with instructions. First, we track down a standard box fan, like the ones they sell in just about every hardware store. Then you need a big piece of fabric that's 72 inches wide. That's important because that size will fit neatly on the fan. Gall used cotton batting, like the stuff inside of quilts.
But we don't have that, obviously. I'm not a quilter. What we do have, and they say is okay, is sheets. Cotton or linen work best, they say.
We found an old full-sized flat sheet in the back of a cabinet. That was perfect. Bigger ones could work too, but you'd have to cut them down. So then we took the sheet and we folded it in half lengthwise like a giant hot dog bun. And then I attached the two long sides together very carefully with duct tape. You end up with this big, long tube. And then you take some rubber bands or hair ties or whatever and twist them around one end of the tube like you're putting it in a little ponytail. And now we're on to the last step. We slip the open end of the fabric tube around the edge of the box fan and duct tape it in place. But make sure you don't make this mistake.
I covered up the controls, so that's a little bit silly. That was my mistake. Don't do that.
Then we turn it on.
Ooh. And we have inflated a giant blue tube.
It poofs up and looks exactly like one of those slinky tubes little kids crawl through. Gall says it works best if you can run it in rooms that aren't too big, like overnight in a bedroom, for example. For NPR News, I'm Alejandra Barunda.
It sounds like something out of a movie. A journalist reports on a CEO's alleged misconduct. Then the journalist's home is vandalized. Bricks and rocks thrown through the windows. The words, "just the beginning," spray-painted in red on the walls. This was not, however, a movie. It happened to New Hampshire Public Radio journalist Lauren Chulgen after she published an investigation into allegations of sexual assault and harassment by Eric Spofford, founder of the state's largest network of addiction treatment centers. The story took another turn in recent days when Spofford himself was arrested and accused of orchestrating a conspiracy to vandalize Chuljan's home and the homes of her editor and her parents. And Lauren Chuljan joined me to talk about these developments, and I do want to let our listeners know the story includes a description of alleged sexual assault. So you had been living with this for a while.
Yeah, years.
And then all of a sudden there's this major development, and I'm wondering what your reaction was when you heard the news that Spofford had been arrested.
Well, it was like supposed to be a normal Friday for me, Scott. I was in Target shopping for stuff for my kid's birthday party, and then I see this call come in from the DOJ, and I think, huh. And it's not that I, you know, didn't know they weren't still poking around. But, you know, I mean, we have a new administration now. Priorities have changed in the DOJ's office. And so I just figured maybe they just let it go and they have other priorities. No, never in a million years did I think I'd be standing in a Target in the soap aisle on a Friday getting a call saying Eric Spofford's been arrested.
You then went to the courtroom where he was arraigned earlier this week. What was that experience like?
Yeah, it was kind of wild, to say the least. You know, I went with my family and my boss and my reporting partner, and now the feds are saying that they have evidence that Spofford had organized this whole thing, had asked his close friend to pay some guys to do this. And so he walked in, he looked pretty tired, you know, tight black shirt, black pants, handcuffs on. This is a guy who seemed untouchable. And so to see him in this place, a federal courtroom, it was just something that I thought was just really wild to see. Separate, of course, from then the victim part of me that is in a courtroom because allegedly this man has perpetrated violence on me and my family. I mean, it's a lot to hold in one brain, I can tell you that.
And I should say he was charged with stalking. He has pleaded not guilty to four counts. But I want to shift here and talk about the original reporting. Tell us a little bit more about who Eric Spofford is or was.
Yeah. So Eric Spofford grew up in New Hampshire. He is a person who found sobriety at a young age and then decided that he wanted to use what he had learned and give back to the community in New Hampshire. This is around 2008 that he came on the scene, which of course is a time where New Hampshire, like many other states, was really struggling with the opioid crisis. And we really didn't have that great of a plan for addiction treatment in our state. And so, no exaggeration, politicians in New Hampshire were like, thank God, here's a guy who went from having one sober home to building this huge provider of treatment that was the biggest in New England at the time. And so here's a guy who becomes close to politicians because he's meeting a need that like really needs to be met. He's a local guy, he's charismatic. You know, he accumulated quite a following. And so what I didn't realize until I started reporting, and the tips that we first got, I should say, Scott, this was back in 2020, people were just like, we work here at this company, Granite Recovery Centers. It doesn't feel like people are taking COVID seriously. Maybe you should look into it. And it was from that outbreak story that I ended up getting additional tips that while in the public, Eric Spofford looks one way, it seemed that for decades, there was like a whisper network of people who were saying, no, no, there's more here. And I ended up being able to corroborate multiple allegations of sexual harassment and sexual assault allegedly perpetrated by Eric against former employees and former clients.
And I should say the source did not want to be named because she wanted to keep that part of her life separate.
At that point, he was becoming powerful in the sense that all of the new, you know, teenagers or young 20-year-olds that came in really looked up to him, and he took all those boys and young men under his wing. And it's kind of like, looking back now, you can almost think of like an evangelist or something like that, that can, you know, get people enraptured with what they're saying. Because let me tell you, what he ended up being like was like the supreme commander of recovery.
You know, this is 2008. This is when Eric had only a sober home. She had run into him at a 12-step meeting. And he already had this persona behind him, especially for other people who are looking for sobriety.
And there's another side of the story. There's a more specific side of the story about serious sexual misconduct allegations. What did you learn there?
So I learned that there were multiple allegations of sexual harassment and sexual assault involving Eric and former clients and former employees of his treatment center. So oftentimes the dynamic was that a woman in recovery was in a vulnerable spot and allegedly, you know, here comes Eric, a guy who seems to have it all. So it's hard to say no. But that also happened allegedly with women who weren't in recovery who worked for him.
And again, I'll just say to listeners, we're not using this next person's name because she feared retaliation.
he was very quick to like just pull me in and start kissing me, and then he went to his desk and he grabbed out a condom, and we did end up having sex on his couch in his office.
Did you want that to happen?
No. But I also didn't know how to tell him no.
Lauren, let's just recap. You report this series of stories about these serious allegations of abuse and retaliation. Mm-hmm. In the process, you are retaliated against yourself. Your home is attacked. You are seriously threatened. And now the federal government is alleging that the executive you were reporting on was behind the whole thing. That is a lot.
Yeah.
You have continued to be a journalist. And I'm wondering, has this investigation, has its aftermath changed the way you approach that job?
Oh, yeah. Even before the vandalism, what I learned from having all these conversations with these women who had these allegations was, this is unlike any kind of reporting I had done before. I have learned so much about how to be a trauma-informed reporter and understanding that sometimes sources are going to drop out on you. And while that might not feed your deadline, you have to respect where they're coming from. Because what happened to them and what's in their body and how they want it, you know, put out in the world or not, that's the number one most important thing. And if they're not there and if they're not ready, there's nothing I can do about it. And it's not a failure on me and it's not a failure on them. This stuff is so, so complicated. And I say that as like, that was all before I experienced my own trauma in this reporting and my own retaliation, which is what they were all afraid of.
Like, you can know that in theory and think you're being really sensitive to that, but then going through a situation like that, you just understand it on a deeper, deeper level.
100%. And I think what's unique now that Eric Spofford has been arrested, it's also like pushed that into a whole new category where I have my sources coming to me saying, now we all have a story about Eric. And that is a position, Scott, I could have never imagined. And who has the guidebook for that? And yet I'm really determined to continue to do the right thing because this reporting is so important.
That is New Hampshire Public Radio's Lauren Chulgen. Lauren, we appreciate your reporting and we appreciate you talking to us today.
Thanks. I appreciate you.
Spofford has denied all allegation, has not been charged for anything related to sexual misconduct. In 2022, Spofford sued Chulgen, two fellow journalists, and New Hampshire Public Radio for defamation. Those claims were dismissed. We reached out to Spofford's lawyer about the information in the story, and we were told that his client had no comment. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.